a review really of in the support desk of how things have changed over the course of the year, what kind of things we were dealing with in Jan, Feb, and how that changed in March, April, May, and then as we progressed through the summer, and then as we got towards the Brexit, you know, the nature of the inquiries that's come inbound has changed dramatically. So we thought we'd have a look at the top 10. So I'm joined today by Ollie, who's been basically running the support desk all year, and also Jasmine. It's Jasmine's first time she's participated in one of these, so we'll ask Jasmine to introduce herself in a minute, but we're going to try and go easy on her and not give her any really tough questions to answer. Jasmine, do you want to say hi?
So hi everyone. I've been with Data Protection People for, well, since March, but it's been a bit of an unconventional journey, let's say. I've been working on the support desk for a few months now, helping Ollie out.
So I last saw you in February when I interviewed you.
So we've been seeing each other virtually every day though.
Exactly. Yes. So hopefully things will get back to normal. Ollie, are you going to say hello?
I will indeed. Thanks, Phil. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. If you've been on any of these before, you'll have the pleasure, no doubt, of having heard my voice in the past, as well as Phil's. So today's session, I mean, it's quite informal, really, more of a chat around the most common issues that we deal with. If you've got any questions at any point, do put them in the chat and we'll pick them up and deal with those, or use that feature to raise your hand and unmute and fire in a question, because we're happy to field them at any point. So I think, Phil, we're recording this session, is that right?
Yeah, I'm just finding the privacy policy to display. Yes, hang on a second, here it is indeed. Yes, I shall share my screen and display that. Yes, we are.
I will let you fill everyone in on that point.
Well, we're going to record it. We've been recording a few of these just to give people an opportunity of listening back over them, and some of them we're going to have been carving up into mini podcasts, so topical podcasts. So again, if you don't want to feature in it, you know, don't raise, you know, answer, ask any questions, whatever. If you do object to this, you know, later on, you know, we're happy to sort of edit out any contributions for that. But if nobody's going to, you know, mind, we're going to do a recording of this one, and there's a privacy notice there which we can send on later, really, about how we intend to use the recording. Ollie, you were digging about in what's been, there's some interesting stuff been in the news, hasn't there? I haven't had a chance, because I've been really busy with other stuff, but what's been going on then this last couple of weeks in the land of data protection stuff?
Yeah, plenty going on. I'm sure people will be aware that the CNIL have been the French data protection authority have been particularly active at the minute. So we had fines handed down to Carrefour, which were particularly big a couple of weeks ago, as well as Google. And then the most recent one is Amazon, who they've handed down a fine of €35 million to for breaches around advertising cookies and placing them on users' devices without their consent and without letting them know.
£35 million?
£35 million, yeah. Wow. Which for Amazon, I suppose, is a drop in the water, really, considering how big they are at the minute. But having said that, I think it probably serves as a reminder to us all that, you know, cookie compliance is important and it needs to be looked at, because I feel like it is something which does often go by the wayside. I don't know how you feel about that, Phil, but I often have clients say, oh yeah, but I looked at, you know, the M&S website or a big supplier and they're not compliant according to what you're saying. And it's sort of like, well, yeah, but you know.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I've had a customer who's been had an objection to using tracking pixels in emails. So again, they rang the support desk and they were saying, well, you know, how is this the same as cookies? You know, there's a lot of people don't understand the technology, what it's doing. And when you say, well, you've got to audit it and get to the bottom of what's going on, it's actually quite hard. You know, who's placing those tracking pixels? How do you know they're there? You know, and what are they actually doing? You know, what are they actually tracking? But what's interesting also is the ICO can only fine a maximum of £500,000 for PECA trans non-compliances, can't they, at the moment?
Mm.
So they have to be taking an action about a PECA non-compliance and the GDPR non-compliance, getting to those higher levels of fine.
Yes, because you're absolutely right. And a lot of the time what we're seeing is fines under PECA, but then are supported by Fines in the GDPR mostly for breaches around privacy information and consent. Because obviously when we're talking PECA and cookies, those issues sort of go hand in hand, if you like.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, another news item I found this week that I found was thought was quite interesting. The APD, so that's the Spanish Data Protection Authority, they're always quite busy as far as I'm aware. They've handed down a total fine of €5 million to BBVA, who are a bank, for multiple breaches, but in the main it's for failing to provide adequate privacy information and then subsequently sending out marketing texts without appropriate consent.
Right.
So that all links in. And I think it's what we were discussing the other day, wasn't it, that we're seeing quite a lot of activity on the PECA and direct marketing enforcement fronts at the minute.
Yeah, I don't know if it's my end, but I've got some very sort of patchy signals. So I don't know if I keep drifting in and out, then apologies, but you dropped out there, Ollie. I don't know if it's you or me.
I don't know, unfortunately, but hopefully not too many issues. And then, yeah, finally, there are a couple of other bits which we discussed this morning, which I thought were quite interesting. So the first of which is the Irish Data Protection Authority. So that's the Data Protection Commission, I think they're called. And they've handed out a fine to Twitter recently for about €500,000, more or less. And those failures, the fines rather, relate to failures on breach reporting obligations to the supervisory authority. Now, that in and of itself isn't particularly newsworthy, I would argue. We do hear and see a lot of...
Is that under the GDPR, or is that as a telco under the PECA?
No, it's under the GDPR.
Right, okay.
It's specifically obligations relating to Article 33,
yeah, okay.
1 and 5, I think,
yeah.
If you go and have a look at the judgment. But yeah. What's really interesting about this is that, and I thought it was worth mentioning, it's that the European Data Protection Board actually got involved, because under the consistency mechanism at Article 60 of the GDPR, if there are disagreements to ensure consistency across the board and across supervisory authorities, matters can be referred to the European Data Protection Board for their opinion. And in very specific instances, the European Data Protection Board can make a binding ruling on a decision. And this is what happened in this case. As far as I'm aware, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, is the first time this has actually happened. Now, I need to dig into it further, but it looks really quite interesting. There's a 200-page judgment on it, which is probably worth reading, but I've not had the time as of yet.
Didn't you mention a overseas housing client got fined as well?
I did indeed. Actually, Ian...
Is that CCTV?
Yeah, Ian's posted a very helpful link, GDPR enforcement tracker, in the chat for all those who are interested. Yeah.
The Spanish really are being useful. The most active, haven't they? I mean, they've raised 160 fines or something.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really useful resource, Ian, for all those interested. But yeah, just to finish on the last piece of news that I thought was really interesting this week, for all our housing clients particularly, although not limited to them, a Swedish housing provider have been fined by their supervisory authority about €300,000, more or less. Obviously they use the krona, but still roughly equivalent, for unlawful CCTV use and unlawful CCTV processing. So what appears to have happened is that in a communal block, they'd installed CCTV to monitor disturbances and issues that were going on in the communal areas. However, the way they'd set it up, it basically captured everyone coming into and leaving the building, including the front doors of two tenants that were in full view of this camera. And basically it's been deemed that that's not a proportionate approach to resolving disturbances, and so therefore they've been fined. So it's a word of warning to those in the housing sector, really, that, you know, CCTV issues are one to be considered and one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, we know that. I mean, our good friend Jason Ellis raised two really interesting stories to me, and he might want to sort of chip in, because I've seen he's on the call, I think. And Swedish regulators issued a fine for a university using a cloud platform where the data is going to America and not having the appropriate lawful mechanism in place. So again, I have to say I haven't downloaded and translated and read the judgment in detail, but again, that's interesting. That's the first time, as far as I'm aware, and as far as Jason said, that there's been a fine issued for that. If you want to come in, Jason, do. The other one was the Norwegian Data Protection Authority has issued a warning on transfers to the UK after Brexit, basically saying that on the 31st of December, the Brexit transition will end. This means that, amongst other things, that anyone who transfers personal data to the United Kingdom after this date must follow the rules on the transfer of personal data to third countries. That's a pretty bold statement. They're the first regulator to come out. You know, maybe that's to put pressure on the negotiators, don't know, but you know, still all very much up in the air, isn't it, the Brexit and international transfers piece?
No, absolutely. I mean, we've done 2 hours in the last few weeks.
But the Swedish one's but the Swedish one's interesting, because, you know, if the fine issued for this, you know, non-compliance with the Article 4-6 international transfers bit, then, you know, it's a thin end of a wedge, isn't it? I mean, I was on to people about Salesforce last week. Salesforce got this new product out, which is it just happens to have been launched at the right time. They called it Shield, and you pay a surcharge of 30% of your license fee, and all your data is encrypted, and Salesforce don't have any access to the encryption key. So it seems to comply with the supplementary measures set out by the European Data Protection Board the other week. The other thing that you get as part of that is a lot of monitoring and a lot of logging. So, you know, it's a much more enhanced package. It's going to cost you more. But, you know, that might mean that even if the data is in Germany or the UK and Salesforce covered by Pfizer 701, you know, then if you were to buy this package, as far as I can see, and I've asked Salesforce for more information about it, as far as I can see, you probably can demonstrate you got those supplementary measures in place, knowing that America is going to fail that European Essential Guarantees test.
That is very interesting. I think it's quite interesting to see the different approaches to this, because I don't know if anyone else on the call has noticed this in the last couple of weeks, but as far as I'm aware, Facebook have decided to move all of their UK user data directly to the US, as opposed to hosting it in Ireland, which obviously the Schrems judgment rests on to a degree. Now, the piece I read about this was to the effect that European privacy standards are so much higher than US privacy standards, and was to get around that, sort of glossing over the fact that we're most likely going to get a UK GDPR, so I don't know how big of a difference it'll make. But in terms of seeing a different approaches to the problem, I think that's actually quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw something the other day. I wrote a blog about it, actually, on our website, about Apple. Apple have introduced some new measures that their app developers have got to publish, you know, information about.
Yes.
Yeah, did you see that? Yeah. Now, you know, the only choice you've got is don't download the app. So it's a bit of a, like, okay, fine, we've enhanced transparency, but, you know, if you want the app, you've got to accept these terms. So, quite interesting there. Anyway, listen, we haven't, Jasmine, anything that you've seen that you want to throw into the mix?
Not exactly, Phil. Just reiterating what Ollie said about, you know, the French fine and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. Right, so this week we wanted to talk through kind of just the types of things that have come in and how that's changed during the course of the year, and possibly even kind of thinking about what might be coming in January, February. Ollie, I know that you've been running the support desk, so maybe you're best to kind of organise the discussion and take it forward. So what's been the kind of the way that things have changed over the year for you?
Yeah, so just thanks, Phil. So just quickly, for those who are possibly less familiar with our support desk function, because I know that we have a mix of clients and possibly non-clients on the call, but we essentially have this function like you would have any other IT support desk, where you write in with your issues and we'll look to resolve it. But we do that obviously for data protection and all associated privacy issues. So we get all sorts. I mean, we really do get absolutely all sorts in. And as you say, it's changed over the course of the year. Now, we thought it'd be quite interesting to just sort of take, as per the title of the session, sort of the top 10 most common questions that we receive in support, or the most common issues that we deal with. Just for a little bit of perspective, Jasmine, I'm going to come to you on this, if that's all right. Since you've joined us, or since you've started working on support more, what are some of the things that you've come across most, you know, the most common questions, issues, cases that you've dealt with?
So a lot of common areas that I've come across include queries about data sharing agreements, including controller to controller and controller to processor, you know, reviewing them, reviewing suppliers' due diligence, data protection impact assessments, determining whether organizations are controllers or processors. Their and lawful basis as well. That's another one. Choosing a lawful basis to rely on. They tend to be the most popular, I'd say.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with you on that. So I think maybe if we dive straight in and we get into some of these topics. So we've outlined, as I said before, a top 10, although 9 of those are actually the most common ones that we deal with. And then the final one we split into 2 because it's things which have affected us this year. So code and Brexit anomaly. And we'll get to those in time. But if we pick on one of those first ones that you mentioned, Jasmine, so sharing agreements, whether those are controller or controller processor, what are some of the most common things that you come across, some of the biggest issues?
Yeah, what do people struggle with, Jasmine? Are they saying, you know, people understand process agreements, it's determined in Article 28, but, you know, if you say, somebody sends you a sharing agreement to review, you know, what are you meant to be measuring it against? You know, there's no, you know, set out structured framework for it. I mean, what kind of things do people ask you to review? You know, review this and sign it off, or can you write one for me? What type of stuff comes up?
Well, we usually do get them sent through, asking us to review if they're to an acceptable standard, in a way compliant, even though it's not really set out within the GDPR or data protection laws. But the more to ensure that appropriate technical and organisational measures are agreed upon within both organisations between the data process and activities that they're both undertaking. They kind of follow the similar fashion to data processing agreements to make sure that everything's laid out how it should be, you know, the details of data processing, the appropriate security measures are in place. Both parties are due.
So do you have a checklist then? If you've got like a checklist you go through and say, you know, this is our model contract, it should have this stuff in it, and you get what you get sent through and you say it's got that, it's got that, hasn't got that.
So we do with data processing agreements, they usually have to be compared against Article 28 and 32 to 36. So Article 28 is the details of data processing, which I do find that tends to a lot of agreements tend to lack. So
do they still?
Well, I think a lot of in controller and processor relationships, I think a lot of agreements are used as templates, so they won't have specific details of, you know, the nature and purpose of processing, the types of personal data, the categories of data subjects. So it's more trying to advise clients to, you know, go into more detail and specifically lay out these details so, you know, both parties are confined to that processing.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually, Jasmine, that is that we do often see sort of a real lack of detail in them. And I think a lot of that, as you said, quite rightly, comes down to the fact that we have organisations that use templates. Now, there's obviously nothing inherently wrong with using a template. If anything, that's what I would recommend most of the time, because then you can be... you can have a greater degree of certainty that template is up to scratch if you've had it reviewed. However, what you then do often find is that the templates aren't used correctly. And as you say, there's a lack of detail in there. But yeah, I think it's quite concerning, if anything, actually, Phil, something that Jasmine's hit on there, is that we still see a lot of agreements, particularly data processing agreements, which, as we've established, do have a standard, you know, set out in the law, that are not up to scratch.
It's funny, isn't it? Because in my experience, a lot of people just terrified as soon as they see a document that looks like a contract or says contract or agreement on it, then they go into this panic mode, and, you know, it's just a document. And the trouble is that some of them use really tricky language. You know, it's quite tricky, you know, to understand the legal implications of the language being used, which is why I guess people do potentially go into panic mode. But there's just a document. There's nothing at all to be concerned about. You know, what we're trying to do is, it's, I mean, you know, this is the stuff that should be in there, either by law or as a kind of measure of best practice. And is it there? You know, and you know, and then, well, if it is there, you know, is it worded adequately and correctly, or is it, you know, woolly, or, you know, does it give the parties too much flexibility, would we think, you know? So I don't know why people do panic about these things, but we get a lot through it. The other thing is, well, who sends them through? Who's being asked to sign off these post agreements? Is it your operational people who might not know the detail? They might not be coming across contracts every day, or is it your governance people? Because if you're pushing it out to your organisation saying, you know, you want to appoint this process, so you have a look through the contract, well, you're not going to get necessarily qualified or competent people doing that task.
Yeah, that is actually a really good point, Phil. And I think it's important to bear in mind that our contacts in organisations do vary wildly, and the relationship we have with them will vary wildly. So in some instances, for example, we might have contacts who are DPOs and who are bogged down in operational stuff. So they will just send over the agreements to say, look, could you just pick this up for me, review it, make sure it's up to scratch? You know, and there's sort of no doubt there that the DPO could review that themselves and it would be fine, but they're just, you know, the overflow is coming to us. There are situations, however, as you've quite rightly said, where it's operational side and they don't necessarily know what they're looking for, and the point of contact on the other end of the contract, so the supplier, also doesn't really know what they're looking for. And that's when things get a little bit tricky.
So is that a training issue then? And making sure you've got a really buttoned down procedure with good guidance, so that if you're going to distribute it out, you've got to train people how to go through the procurement process, don't you? You want to appoint this person. Yeah. You know, it's a lot easier if they're a person. I mean, do you remember the first time that Salile got asked, you know, can you write me a data sharing agreement? She's like, what do you want it to say? it was like that, wasn't it? You know, we can do, but what do you want it to say? You know, we don't know. There's no framework, as Jasmine quite rightly said. There's no framework in the law. It's got to have this, this, and this in it. Therefore, you know, what should it have in? You know, that needs thinking about outside of, you know, as a governance piece, you know, and then rolling out, doesn't it? And then reviewing, you know, are we asking the right things? Have we got the right things in? But
no, absolutely.
Sorry, Ali and Phil. with regards to sharing agreements between controllers, one thing that I do find is that they tend to be one-sided, usually with on the side of the organisation that supplied the agreement.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously it is to, you know, lay down the process and activities between both parties and equal responsibilities.
Yeah. And what I've found, which is probably common, you know, we're the same, aren't we? If we're going to go into an agreement with somebody, we'd prefer them to foot the legal bill and get the contract drafted. But you know, that's generally what happens, doesn't it? So you get all these different people supplying with all these different agreements and they just need evaluating.
Yeah. Just to move us on, because I am conscious of time, onto our next point, but I think it ties in quite nicely at this juncture, because you mentioned, Phil, maybe possibly a lack of awareness or training or a bit of panic around the issue. Something that we do see a whole lot of in support are DPIAs, which are to an extent sort of intrinsically linked with sharing agreements, because often that's a risk that we would look at. But all too often it's a risk which actually doesn't really get given enough weight. So we're going through a DPIA for a client, they're using a new piece of software or whatever it might be, a new supplier. And we'll sort of say, well, have you done due diligence? Have you entered into an agreement? And a lot of the time the response comes back, well, no, not yet. We've not gotten to that stage. Now, obviously that can vary depending on at what point you're undertaking the DPIA. But DPIAs, I know we've spoken about them quite a lot in the past. There are still issues with them, particularly, I think, from a possibly a cultural perspective.
But has that improved over the year? I mean, I looked at a DPIA yesterday for a client and it was absolutely fabulous. It's the best one I've seen. It was written by some lawyers, actually Sheridan's lawyers, and it was really well structured, reasoned, referenced, you know, it was good. Some of the points I didn't agree with, and actually the DPIA was dated July 18 and it was about PECA and it hadn't folded in the ICO's new guidance. So, you know, it's not, but it was a really well put together document. Are they improving or are they still, you know, hard to work with?
I would say generally, Phil, that they are improving in certain circumstances. So I think where there is training, where there is an understanding of fundamentally what the point of a DPIA is, you know, its actual purpose, its use, its value in to the organisation. We do definitely, and I've seen it when working with specific individuals within an organisation who, by virtue of their role, end up doing quite a lot of DPIAs. They, you know, their ability to complete them does improve dramatically. But often what you see is that that's that one individual, their skill in that department has improved, and it's not necessarily been a constant trend throughout all organisations over the year, I would say.
Yeah. And you've done quite a lot, Jasmine, haven't you? Project work for some of the consultants, you know, they throw you a deep A and say, right, come on, get your teeth into that, review that, pick holes in that, see if it's any good. What's your experience of working with them? Do you find, you know, some really good, some really bad, or all really bad, or all really good? You know, what have you found in the last?
I think it varies a little bit, but I think a main issue is the detail that goes into them. I don't think people realise that, you know, every aspect of the new process and activity needs to be documented and considered.
It's the data flows, isn't it, sometimes that's missing, you know, where the data is actually flowing.
Yeah, the processes of them, yeah.
And I mean, I know Dilik's great at this. She's kind of like, show me evidence. You know, she's fantastic at that. That's why she's doing auditing now. But, you know, she's saying, yeah, don't just tell me, show me. You know, well, why isn't it taken to that extent in a DPA? It's often, well, the supplier says this, therefore that's probably fine. Well, no, it's not, you know, go deeper.
Yeah, I think that's the lack of understanding, you know, of people completing them that needs to be kind of forced on people.
No, I completely agree. And actually, Phil, that's a really lovely segue that you've created for me there into next point. Yeah. about suppliers providing evidence.
You think we'd rehearse, didn't you?
Yeah, almost. Suppliers providing evidence, because a lot of what we do also revolves around due diligence and onboarding suppliers. Now, Jasmine, since you've joined, you've actually undertaken a few of these projects, haven't you?
Yeah, luckily.
So what are some of the things that you've come across, some of the issues, anything that sort of possibly tripped you up maybe when you first started with them?
Yeah, I think a common issue that I find with due diligence, we usually send out questionnaires and ask suppliers to fill them in and return them back to us. And it might not be completed to, you know, a sufficient degree for us to be able to review it. And a lot of the time they tend to lack evidence along with what they're saying, so documentation.
Do you think we've got that right though? I mean, I'm still not convinced that we went through this, didn't we, about a year ago. Are we asking the right questions here? You know, what are we actually trying to review? You know, we're trying to review what risk does this supplier pose to our client, the controller? You know, whether they put, if it's a process, whether they put privacy information out, you know, to their own employees, do we really care about that? What we're bothered about is what risk, and it's usually security, does this supplier pose to my client? You know,
I think that's an important point to consider, is the fact that the level of processing that the supplier will undertake, you know, if it was a one-off processing activity, for example, a plumber, you don't need to know, you know, their privacy information or anything.
I think that's an extremely valid point, Jasmine. I think it's something which we spoke about when you first started, is the proportionality of it. Mm. I think you're both absolutely right on those points. I mean, to a degree, if you, that privacy information point, Phil, I mean, maybe that's more relevant for, I mean, maybe it's not ever relevant, but it's possibly more relevant for high risk processing or a supplier that's going to be handling a lot of data. But we see instances where, you know, it's not been a tailored approach. So as Jasmine said, sort of a one man band, maybe a plumber or a painter decorator or something, is receiving this, you know, questionnaire that's arguably been designed for the likes of
Microsoft,
you know, payroll. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you have to take a proportionate approach to it.
And what we're trying to do is, you know, you get a good feel, don't you, for, right, okay, well, if they don't get the basics right, then they're probably not going to be getting some of the more detailed stuff right. But it's getting that balance, you know, and I'm not sure we've got that yet. I don't think we've got that balance right. It's, you can't just have one due diligence questionnaire. You know, you need to take a balanced approach depending upon the circumstances. But I think there's more work to do on that next year to kind of, you know, explore that again and get some better models together and really get back to the question, why are we doing this? You know, what is it we're trying to demonstrate? And what happens if we get the wrong answers to the questions? I've been doing a lot of work, due diligence on the suppliers in a payment gateway for a city council. You know, and they're getting questionnaires back. No, we don't do this. No, we don't. We never change passwords. Okay, so what are you going to do about it? You know, I mean, literally, we never change passwords on our portal. Well, that's an absolutely basic vulnerability, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what are you going to do? Are you going to stop using them, or are you going to just accept that as a risk? You know, so you do the due diligence, but then what happens?
No, absolutely. It's really quite difficult. And I think, and again, I'm trying to segue as best I can here. I think a lot of it will come down to an issue which we see a lot, which is our fourth point for today, which is issues around the dynamics between, you know, organizations, between controls and processes, determining that relationship, what it is. I mean, the number of times I've had arguments with our client suppliers because they believe themselves to be a controller when we think they're a processor or vice versa. I mean, it's a real issue. Jasmine, I think maybe you've come across that as well, yeah, to a degree, have you?
Yeah. I think there's a common misconception that where a party is handling personal data, even possibly to draw conclusions such as writing reports, this can make them a data controller. But I think what people fail to realise is that if they're doing that on behalf of another organisation, then they're processing on behalf of that organisation and they are a data processor.
I've found, again, look, I was looking at links to this DPI I said was really good. I was looking at the kind of the nature of the relationship, and basically it's these people are supplying data, you know, so they're collecting data from various other public sources and then they're supplying it commercially to other organizations to use for their sales prospecting. But until you break down what's going on in terms of, you know, this task, you're acting as a controller, collecting the data in the first place. This task, you're transferring it to my client, you know, so the lawful bases and what your expectations are for both of those activities is different. You know, and then my client, you know, wanting to use that data. It's now different again, you know. So at some point, the controller becomes a processor for certain activities. But until you actually get your head around exactly what's going on, it's very hard to, I think, make that determination.
It's extremely complicated at times. You're absolutely right. And I've had instances where, and I think, Jasmine, possibly you may also have witnessed this, but where we basically get sent what appears on the face of it to be quite a simple query. You know, we've got this supplier, we work with them. This is basically what we do. What's the relationship? And you go, well, on the face of it, that seems pretty simple. That seems control processor. But then all of a sudden, you know, there's a sort of a smoking gun that appears out of nowhere. There's a little bit of detail that you hadn't previously been told about. And you go, well, hang on a second, this completely changes the dynamic. So I had one recently where it seemed like quite a clear-cut control processor situation because in theory, our client was appointing the supplier. But in fact, it turned out that they were selecting a supplier out of a small number that had previously been instructed by a separate funder, who were local authorities in England. And all of a sudden, I mean, that completely changes the dynamic. Where do you stand at that point? So it can be really quite complicated at times. Phil, any more thoughts on that?
No. I think that's the
complexity. Yeah.
I mean, we try and get that across in the training we do, don't we? It's a continuum, you know, I think, between controller and processor. At some point, you know, somebody's more likely to be a processor than they are a controller. But again, yeah, my advice to everybody is you got to think this through and break down the actual tasks, the processing tasks, and then think about, you know, who's determining what's happening in those tasks. And that only until you've done that and broken it down into component parts can you start to say, well, for these tasks, you're a controller, and for these tasks, you're a processor, and for those tasks, you're a joint controller. And you know, some of these relationships are very, very complex.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, sometimes that's, you know, the only way to get around that is to, as you say, get your head around it, get on a call with the supplier, say, right, what specifically are you doing here? Why are you doing this?
Yeah. And then, of course, what we've been doing for the last few weeks is then, well, okay, then tell me where this activity takes place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Oh, okay. That's another dimension, isn't it?
Yeah. We'll get on to Brexit, hopefully, although, I am conscious of time. So,
She talk too much, Dolly.
Yeah, no, I do rub it on. You need to just
go on, crack on.
Yeah, interrupt. The fifth point that we set out was lawful basis. So that's something we get a huge amount of.
I'd have thought that had died off now.
You'd be surprised. It's, can we rely on a legitimate interest? Can we rely on consent? What are the conditions around that? Do we need to do a legitimate interest assessment? Is this consent valid? We've got, or just simply as broad as, we want to do this project, what do we need to think about? And you sort of go, well, first things first, let's look at the lawful basis. Jasmine, I mean, have you dealt with much of this already?
Yeah, one thing that I do find is I think a lot of people tend to assume that they need to rely on consent for certain activities, where legitimate interests may be a more appropriate option to take. And there's not as many obligations, you know, by law to comply with when using it. So.
Yeah, I find this, I mean, feel free to jump in, Phil, and contradict me, but I find it baffling that there's still this sort of conception that you can only do things on the basis of consent. The number of times I started to deal with queries where someone said, hang on a second, you can't do this without my consent. You go, well, actually, no, we've got a legitimate interest. I mean, that probably highlights issues more with privacy information and fair and law, fair and transparent processing than anything else. But still, I see a lot of issues with lawful basis. I don't know if you've had any run-ins recently.
I keep coming up against, right, we're doing direct marketing. Legitimate interest is our lawful grounds. Fine. Okay. What sort of direct marketing are you doing? Emails. Well, that ain't good enough. You know, you cannot use legitimate interest. PECA, you know, if it's unsolicited direct marketing by email, you have to have consent. Oh, no, we don't. It says in recital 47, I got the other day. No, it doesn't. You know, it's frustrating that people are still, you know, in that situation, getting everything, it seems to me, muddled up into one and not being able to distinguish, you know, between, right, for this activity, I need that, and for that activity, I can rely on that.
Mm. You're absolutely right. And, well, I had Pecker on my list as a point that we were going to get to, so we may as well get straight into that. The thing is, I often refrain, because in theory, Phil, I mean, correct me if I'm, yeah, absolutely wrong on this, but from the GDPR's perspective, you can use legitimate interest for direct marketing.
Absolutely.
But then obviously you need a consent under PECA if it's via email. And I'll be honest with you, a lot of the time, I sort of actively omit that piece of information for clients because I know that they're going to go, well, hang on a second, you said we could use legitimate interest a minute ago, why do we now need consent?
Yeah.
So I just say, look, just get a consent because that's, you know, easier for your purposes. But we get a lot of queries coming in which are, well, we want to send this out. We want to send out this email, this text, whatever it is. We've got this campaign. Can we do that? And then determining whether it's direct marketing, whether they might have a soft opt-in under PECA, whether their consents are valid. How do we go about reobtaining consents if they don't have them? We get a huge amount of that. I mean, I know you and I, Phil, worked on a few PECA projects a while back. That was really flavour of the week for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah. Do you find, Jasmine, that people have not heard of the PECA? I mean, maybe people just, you know, the GDPR was a bit of a song and a dance about it, and before that, the Data Protection Act. I mean, PECA has been around since 2003, so it's not new, you know, but is there still people who haven't heard about it? What do you think? Do you find that, or do you find that people have heard about it, but just struggle to know how to apply it? Because, I mean, it's a big piece of law, isn't it? And it covers a lot more than just unsolicited direct marketing.
Yeah, I think a lot of people tend to focus on the GDPR a lot more. And probably don't understand PECA, and you need to break that down for them, you know, in responses to queries, because it is a different approach, isn't it?
And yeah, I have to say the new ICO PECA, well, new, it's been around for a while now, and the recent PECA guidance ICOs issued, I think, is really good. I mean, the last lot was pretty left too many unanswered questions, but it's really clear on things like B2B marketing and, you know, what is a corporate subscriber and what's a corporate subscriber's email address. It's really, I think, clarified. There's still a few bits that aren't clear, but I think it's done a lot to clarify the situation.
I was just going to say, can I tell you my favourite part of that guidance, Phil?
Possibly
a bit of a sad thing to have a favourite part of a piece of guidance.
But... Oh, I have favourite parts of every guidance. So.
But it's the fact that they make it quite clear that even regulatory communications can be caught within the scope of PECA and require compliance, because the number of times that I have been,
I know exactly
where I'm going with this. The number of times where I have been working with clients in the housing sector and they have obligations under the tenant empowerment standard, I think, are set by the regulator for social housing, rather. And they say, oh, well, we've got a legal obligation to do this. We have to do it. We don't need consent. I say, you do need consent. And we had this argument backwards and forwards for ages. And now finally it's come out that, you know, actually those communications can be caught. So no, I agree with you. I think it's really excellent.
Yeah. Have we had, I mean, our next on your list, is breaches. I'm sorry to segue in your place, but I just wondered whether we've seen a change over the year in the nature of breaches. You know, you've put that on the list, and it's one of the top 10 things that we get through the support desk. You know, what's the story there? I've got my hard hat on. Now we're talking about breaches. Look, I've got my hard hat on.
Anyway,
yeah.
Your data protection officer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We get an awful lot of breaches. And, as I said before, in relation to a different point, it's important to remember that our relationship with different clients varies wildly. So there are plenty of instances where, the clients will have an incident and we will basically deal with it for them, more or less, or, you know, we'll work very closely with them to remedy it, to log it, to assess the reportability, etc. But the most common point really is, do we have to report this to the ICO? Because there's still a huge degree of uncertainty around what is reportable and what isn't reportable. And I mean, fundamentally, the criteria is you have to report unless it's unlikely to pose a risk to the rights and privileges of individuals.
Clear wording. Yeah.
Which is, you know, but the thing is, it can just vary wildly. I mean, we had an incident a while back, or we've had many incidents actually along similar lines, to be completely honest, where organizations are possibly more concerned with the scale of an incident rather than the, you know, severity of the potential repercussions on an individual. So, I mean, we work a lot in social housing, as some might be aware on the call. And you can have instances there where you have ASB cases that can turn really quite nasty, and a breach can lead to, you know, physical harm. And that arguably is far more severe than someone being accidentally copied into an email, or even a couple hundred people accidentally being copied into an email. But as soon as you start to, you know, involve factors like scale, I think it blurs the lines, and it makes it difficult.
I think you're right. People say, well, it's only two people. Yeah, we've lost, we've lost the passports and three utility bills and bank statements of two people. So that's not important. Well, it is to those two people.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. Scale is a consideration, but, you know, it's assessing the impact of the likely repercussions. And, you know, we always put our doom and gloom glasses on, don't we? You know, instead of having rose tinted, we have our dark glasses on. We say, well, you know, this is what could happen. You know, these people could get beaten up. They could get murdered. They could commit suicide. You know, these things could happen, have happened. Yeah. You know,
I think it's confusing scale with impact there. Like, they don't go hand in hand exactly, you know, with the severity of a breach.
Have you had to handle a lot of inbound breach?
I've had a couple, and I have seen that arise, where I think the way that breaches are judged is not taken in the best approach, you know, as even with regards to reporting it to the ICO.
Yeah. Is there still this reluctance to admit that there's been a breach, or are people becoming a bit more, right, okay, well, breaches happen, you know, it's just how you respond to them that's the key. What's the story there, do you think?
I'd say it's the opposite. There's this panic that they have committed a breach, even where, you know, it potentially hasn't, but that awareness.
Why is that, then? Is that driven by a fear of fines? You know, oh, Christ, if we've had a breach, we're going to get a fine type approach. But what is that, what drives that behaviour? Because in the main, I mean, a lot of the breaches that we've passed on or advised, right, you better report this, or actually got on the phone and reported it for our clients. In the main, the ICO has kind of said, well, you know, fine, thanks for letting us know. Keep us in the loop, haven't they? They've been pretty, there's not been many where the, you know, the Watford springs to mind, but that I think we've got brought in at the last minute on that one, didn't we, once it had happened?
Yeah. I think to be honest, and I mean, as with everything I've said today, correct me if you feel otherwise, but I think generally the regulator is more interested in the big ticket numbers. And I think they're sort of looking for the ones which they can really come down hard on a breach and possibly hand out quite a hefty fine and make a statement. I think that sort of echoes through to the way in which they handle breaches on a smaller level. Because you're absolutely right, there are instances where we've reported a lot of breaches, and I report breaches for clients on their behalf all the time. And the regulator or the, you know, their office just comes back and sort of says, well, you know, we'll be in touch if we need, if we need to be. But
I'm not sure I agree with your perspective there, because they still prosecute individuals, don't they? For, you know, and they only get like 300 quid when they prosecute individuals. So I'm not sure that they're only looking for big ticket stuff, but maybe, you know, they're looking at all the breaches that are reported in across the whole country, and they make a quick, well, they make a quick assessment, you know, on the grand scale of breaches, you know, this is fairly small beer. Maybe, I don't know. But Jasmine, do you think that they're only looking for the big numbers to drive up their income targets, or do you think that they are fairly balanced? I mean, the pecker stuff that they prosecute, I mean, it's easy. It's like, that's easy. It's like shooting fish in a barrel, isn't it, with pecker breaches, you know?
I'm not exactly sure, to be honest, but I've had a few conversations with Ollie where the ICO have come back to organisations and said, we're not interested in this, sort it out, and then if you don't sort it out, we'll come back.
And they do the same with SAR complaints as well, don't they? I mean, their first port of call, you know, so we had this complaint about how you've handled this SAR. Can you sort it out with a data subject? Again, some of our clients think that the ICO is going to hammer them for not dealing with the SAR, but that's not their first step, is it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And actually, I think we mentioned this on a previous session, maybe a couple of weeks ago. Dilip maybe raised it, that sometimes it can just depend on the particular caseworker you get. Because we've had caseworkers who are sort of more willing to ask questions and say, well, hang on, have you actually got a record that, you know, you should have deleted this when you did, or whatever it might be? Have you got evidence of this? But I have to say it's relatively rare.
I was interested to the first day we launched the PCI DSS support desk, we had 16 cases in, which is a lot, isn't it, for a day? But that was quite interesting. Have you seen many other, you know, like, other than data protection coming in? You know, I mean, we only launched the PCI support desk a few weeks ago, didn't we? But have you seen much of those, or do they all get routed through to me?
No, I mean, I try not to deal with them because, frankly, I don't really have the training necessarily, the experience to deal with PCI stuff. But we do see a reasonable amount of queries around generally the handling of payment cards.
Right.
Even if it's not necessarily directly a PCI question. Mm. We do see quite a lot of it. And if you remember, actually, Phil, we had a query, and I'm segueing again, I can only apologise, into COVID, because
you should be on Strictly. You're excellent at this. What a mover.
Yeah, well, we've got the Christmas due later, so so COVID, big issue this year. And if you remember, if we go back to the start of COVID, we had an instance where a client and their staff were taking card payments over the phone whilst working from home.
Yeah.
And someone had raised an issue around this and said, this cannot be compliant with PCI standards, etc. So we do see it. But that was one of the first things that came out of the COVID queries. And we've had quite a few COVID queries, actually. I don't know, Jasmine, if you dealt with any, because I think that was around the time you really started to come into support, or maybe it was a little bit before that. But have you dealt with any at all?
No, not really.
No, I mean, we saw in the main, sort of two avenues or two sets of queries on this, which was the first lot was the entire workforce are now deployed from home. What do we need to think about?
Yeah, I remember. And then,
the second being around, and we did a session on this, test and trace or track and trace in the workplace. We're recording information. What do we need to think about? And those are the two big ones, really. And I mean, it's not surprising, but, The working from home thing threw up a few interesting aspects, which, you know, we had a lot of people sort of saying, well, is there anything we need to think about? And we were sort of saying, possibly slightly unfairly, your policies and procedures will continue to apply as an organisation, and they should really be built in a way that you're more or less set up to cope with this. I don't know if that's particular, maybe, you know, a bit of a high standard to set, Phil, or...
Well, I remember saying to people, you know, why would you not lock your screen if you leave your, you know, let's say, you know, you're living in a shared house or whatever you're doing, you know, people should be drilled on the disciplines of, you know, locking their screens and not, you know, the amount of information that gets winged around on emails as well. I mean, you know, we're all trying to move off emails into, portals, SFTP type portals. But when everyone was first mobilized to home, there's loads of, I remember one of our clients saying, well, they had to collect all the laptops in, because laptops are only given to senior managers. Not sure why. So they collect all the laptops in and then they clean them up and reissue them out to all the frontline staff that are dealing with customers. So that's a massive undertaking. And then they're not ready to mobilize because they're not used to it. They're working from, in that case, a football stadium. It was a football business, they've got people coming in to work every day, machines bolted to the desks, all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, they were faced with this huge task of trying to run the business in a totally different way. I mean, we were really lucky as a business because we were totally geared up to be mobilized anyway, because half of our staff, in fact, about 75% of our staff work remote anyway, don't they, outside of the office?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we definitely saw a stark contrast between the organizations which were more in, our situation, where we were sort of quite fortunate in that we were ready to deploy remotely, and those who were unfortunately not necessarily prepared for it. And it was quite a big task. But we did see a lot around that at the time. That has, as you'd expect, possibly quietened down. That was a big spike in sort of COVID related matters for a while, but we've seen very little of that going forward, despite the fact that obviously there have been degrees of lockdown which vary, and then another national lockdown. But we've still not seen anything really since the first proper lockdown on the COVID front. That has instead been replaced, I think, last topic of the day, by Brexit.
Yeah, well, still a moving
obviously the word on everybody's lips. And we've just had a huge amount of communications over Brexit. And the one thing, actually, and I did want to pick your brains on this, Phil, is of late, what we've seen is our clients reaching out to suppliers who possibly have data centers in the EU, and saying, look, what are you going to do post-Brexit? What are you going to put in place to make sure that we can compliantly retrieve our data from your EU data centers? And on more than one occasion, big US companies who have data centers in the EU saying, well, we're not doing anything. It's not going to affect you. You're a controller. You'll still have the right to retrieve your data. And sort of having to say, well, actually, that's not the point. You have to be putting in place potentially supplementary measures to make sure that your standard contractual clauses are supported if we don't get an adequacy decision, etc. And honestly, a lot of the suppliers that I've dealt with are just not interested. I don't know if you've come across this, Phil, at all, but it's been a real difference.
Yeah, again, I think you're probably right. I think there probably has been a real difference. And, there's still things up in the air. But I mean, that Swedish firm finding that company for using an American platform is potentially thin end of the wedge. I mean, I've absolutely got my head around. I feel like I've absolutely got my head around this now, and I don't think it's as big an issue as I did 6 weeks ago, because bear me out here. I might be talking absolutely nonsense, but I think my take on it is the essential guarantees, European essential guarantees, are territorially based, right? So you've got to do a territorial risk assessment if you're transferring data to a third country. So you've only got to do 248 of those, right? Everybody has only got to do, because once I've done one and assessed the risks in North Korea, you can use exactly the same piece of work because the risks are no different. Because of the way, what we're looking at is the culture, the law, the practice, the case history, the protection of rights. So I think that those European essential guarantees pieces of work will get done by somebody and then shared. Now, I don't think you can commercialize that because it's a common piece of work, I think. And then you're into, right, okay, so now I'm doing a risk assessment at a supplier level. So I've assessed the territory, assessed it's not adequate for these reasons. Now I'm having a look at my supplier. No, okay, fine. They're in that territory and now need to put in place supplementary measures. So the supplier, the supplementary measures that I've got to put in place for my processing are very similar, if not the same, to the supplementary measures you've got to put in place. So I suspect that the bigger companies who've got the resources to mobilize quickly to provide the things like I mentioned about Salesforce, they'll provide solutions to all their EU-based customers, I think. So, you know, I 6 weeks ago, I remember on the call we're saying, you know, this is a nightmare. Controller's got to do all this and this and this and this. Well, they still do, but I think that it's not going to be such an onerous task because I think that some of the work can get recycled. You know, so if you've got a housing client, you know, using a supplier that's got a contact center in India and there's, you know, 30 or 40 social housing providers using the same supplier, you've only got to do the due diligence once and apply supplementaries once. Yeah, everyone's got to apply them, but you know, doing the donkey work doesn't have to be done by everybody all the time. So I think kind of collaborating together is a way of getting through this. But I might be wrong.
No, I think generally that's a good take on it, actually. Yeah. No, I tend to agree with that. I was just I've just seen Caroline's comment in the chat, and I do apologise for not keeping a better eye on the chat throughout this because there's been some really good interactions on there, actually. So anyone who's sort of not
looked at it, so long
been, been reading now. Through it, I definitely recommend that you have a look through some really good conversations on there, particularly around the fine system. Actually, that's quite interesting. But Caroline's made a really interesting comment, or left us a very interesting message, just harking back to that point about the ICO and potential indifference we were saying. I really suggest you read the message that she's put in there, because that's really quite interesting, saying that the ICO basically said, right, in response to a complaint they received, you know, write to the customer, the complainant, tell them exactly what you are doing, explain it and make sure that, you know, they understand. And then in their response, Caroline said, look, this is what we're doing. If you're still unhappy, you can speak to the ICO. And apparently the ICO then said, we note in your correspondence that should Mr. X remain unhappy, he may wish to go back to the Information Commissioner. We suggest that if we receive a further complaint about this processing, we will carefully review and assess the response you've provided to your customer. If we consider that you are infringing data protection law, then we will consider using our formal powers and any sanctions available. That's very odd. They're doing exactly what they've been told to do. It seems like a very strange response to me.
Well, again, I don't know who that's come from. You know, has it come, is it a standard letter? Has it come from, you know, a caseworker? Has it come from a more senior person? I don't know.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Interesting.
I just thought
that was
quite interesting.
Yeah, I tell you that I told you before, haven't I, about the school, the independent school I did work with a couple of years ago, and they had a lot of complaints. They were tracking down the alumni who'd left the school like literally 50 years ago, and they were using all sorts of data tools to track them down, and then, you know, send them requests for bursaries and, you know, fundraising. And a lot of people objected to this, unsurprisingly. And one particular guy did complain to the ICO, and the ICO wrote to the school and asked for the data retention policy and the privacy information and so on and so forth. But anyway, the data retention policy at the time was that they will record and store information about former pupils indefinitely, you know, because it was like, you know, we'll record it until the person dies and then we'll record it thereafter indefinitely. And all the ICO did really was they wrote back and said, we don't think that's appropriate. You need to relook at that. So there was no guidance, no instruction. You know, the instruction was look at it again. So sometimes they take a very light touch approach, too light a touch approach probably. But other times, in this case, saying, you know, get this right or, you know, woe betide you. You read between the lines in there. That's what it seems to say, doesn't it?
Yeah, I have to say that is generally the responses that we've gotten back is, look, sort this out, because if we have to get involved, then we will come down on you like a ton of bricks. But in the first instance, we'll let you deal with it.
Yeah. Marie said that, you know, she's asked about the, I agree with you, Marie, that, you know, Cooper, that, you know, if I'm processing data and I'm putting it into territory like Australia, and Ollie's doing something different with more sensitive data, or, you know, data that needs greater protections. Yes, absolutely. You know, you can't apply the same supplementary measures, but in principle, you know, if we're all doing similar things with similar types of data for similar purposes, then, you know, the supplementary measures, you know, arguably are going to be similar or recycled, but there's only a limit to how far you have to take that. And all I'm trying to say is, you know, if everyone's sitting there thinking, yeah, I've got 100 suppliers, I've got to do, you know, 100 different reviews of America, you've got to do it once. You know, you don't have to do the review of America for each of those suppliers. My take on it is you have to do it once. You then got to do 100 due diligence on your suppliers. But if you've got a company that you're friendly with that's doing the same stuff using the same suppliers, you get to we'll do, as long as you've got an established methodology, we'll do 50 each. You know, that's what I'm trying to say. That I don't think, you know, 6 weeks ago, this seemed like a massive task. And to me, it's a big task, but it's not insurmountable, I don't think. But maybe I've got my rose-tinted specs on again.
Well, we shall see. I think as our colleague Dave Holmes pointed out last time we spoke about this, it's going to be very much supply chain led, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Right, I'm conscious that it is now 13:32, technically over our allocated time. We got through most of the topics, to be fair. There's a couple that we didn't get to, but I think that's probably indicative of
Propensity to yak on, yes, and Jasmine, you couldn't shut her up, could you? Last time we invite you on, Jazzo.
You don't need me.
For reference, the two that we didn't get to were privacy information, privacy notices, which we see a lot of, and instances of ad hoc data sharing.
Well, what do you see on privacy notices? Because, it's formulaic to me. What is it we're seeing, or how's that changed?
They are getting better generally. There are fewer and fewer issues. However, there are still issues. We're just generally asked to review them to make sure that they're up to scratch. So, right. Compare them to articles 13 and 14. They are generally getting better, as I say, but there are still issues generally. And also sort of, I think sometimes people sort of forget that privacy information has to be provided, which is sort of the more worrying thing, where we're looking at a project and they sort of go, okay, so we've got a lawful basis, et cetera. We've determined a retention period or whatever it might be. And then you sort of go, okay, so what privacy information are you providing?
Yeah. I've got an interesting,
I don't know.
I've got an interesting one for you, which I'm working on at the moment. So I said that this company that's supplying, this last thing, right? And that company that's supplying data, right? So I want to buy some data. If the organization I'm buying it from hasn't provided privacy information, so they're getting it from Companies House and various other places. My take on it is under Article 14, they've got to provide privacy information. And if that doesn't name me as a recipient, it's probably not fair processing. Okay. So then I buy a database off them and I want to use it myself. When I contact that person, if I send them a privacy notice saying what I've got to say, plus the source of the data was this person, does that then make it fair? So the fact the data wasn't collected fairly in the first place, does that absolutely inhibit all the use of that data down the line? Or do we suddenly have a break and say, well, because I'm now acting lawfully with that data and I'm providing people the opportunity of opting out and objecting to it and all the rest of it, does that then reset the register for me as an independent controller? I've got to think it through a bit more, but so that's quite an interesting one. If the original supplier hasn't collected it lawfully is okay because it's a legitimate interest, but fairly, does that mean that downstream everything else is knackered, or does that mean that I can actually say, well, I'm going to treat this fairly and lawfully and compliantly, and therefore my use of that data will probably be okay because I could equally have scraped it out of Companies House and websites and everything else, and then told people I've got it. And I would have been compliant in terms of fairness and lawfulness in that way. Anyway, that's an interesting one for Molyneux.
No, absolutely. I think that's probably going to be it for this week. I think we're more or less out of time. I think we addressed most of the sort of questions, or there was some discussion in the chat very helpfully. If any of you do have any questions following this up, do fire them in either to support data protection people or reach out to the person who provided you with this link, and I'm sure they'll be able to put you in touch with us. That's our last one for the year, isn't it, Phil?
It is, yeah. Miles has got a great agenda. I don't know if you're going to circulate it out, Miles, but we've got now planned sessions out till the middle of February, various other things we're going to have a look at. So that again should be quite good. We're going to try and do one a week through January on different topics. We've got International Data Protection Day on the 28th of January, which will be good. We're going to do a 6-hour extravaganza, various things all day, special things for small to medium sized enterprises, special things for sports, special things for education, special things for housing. So we're going to put an agenda together for that. So that'll test our ability to talk all day, won't it?
Yeah.
But anyway, yes, thank you very much, Ollie. You've done a fantastic job of dancing through all these different topics. And thank you very much, Jasmine. You do a great job of, participating and enlightening. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Thanks for everything you've done during the course of the year. It's been an interesting one, a tough one. Have a great Christmas, and we'll look forward to catching up.